Hello and welcome to Talking Europe. My guest today is someone who spends a lot of time thinking about Europe's place in the world and how it can find its feet in the new global order of Donald Trump, Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping. Indeed, an opinion piece by his think tank goes so far as to call this a post-Western world. Luc van Middelaar is a Dutch political theorist and historian, and he's the director of the Brussels Institute for Geopolitics. His books include Pandemonium, which is about how Europe dealt with COVID, The Passage to Europe, and Europe's Geopolitical Awakening. And he joins me from Brussels today. Luc, thank you so much for being my guest. You have something called the 1989 Project, and that, of course, was a year of historic change. Is 2025 a comparable turning point?
Thank you, Armin, for the invitation. And I think, indeed, 2025 might be, in hindsight, at some point, be seen as the same pivotal moment in European or even world history as 1989, the end of the Cold War, 1945, end of the Second World War. We could also look at 2022 at the same time, at Russia's invasion in Ukraine. We will say that it put an end to the world or the period which we refer to as the post-Cold War, the end of the division of Europe, the fall of the Berlin Wall, happy period, end of history, Fukuyama called it. Putin put an end to that already 3 years ago. But in a way, Armin, what Trump does, I would say, is even more fundamental, because what Trump is doing is ending the world order which started in 1945, an 80-year period when U.S. power underpinned the global order, multilateral order, the dollar at the center of that universe, the American army in Europe with NATO to protect us. Now, of course, they're still there, but we can see that order being unraveled. Mm. And that's the kind of, I think, underlying objective in all the actions of the Trump administration, be it his actions and opening actually towards Putin when it comes to the war in Ukraine, but also his contempt for Europe as its historic allies.
Yeah, I want to come back.
So it leaves Europe really exposed.
Yeah, that's right. But on the tariffs, of course, we've seen Trump now reversing his position. What do you think was behind that? What's your interpretation of this reversal?
Well, my interpretation is probably not very original, but he kept his cool for about a week, notwithstanding the bloodbath on the markets. But then at some point, he lost his cool, and then indeed went in the other direction again, because the risks were getting too big for the U.S. itself to enter a recession. The position of the dollar was even starting to be questioned. I think from the start, they were not entirely clear whether they were doing the tariffs to negotiate or really that they wanted to keep the tariffs to bring back industry and manufacturing back to the U.S., which is a goal of some of Trump's advisors, but there are, of course, different schools there in Washington, as there are in Paris, London, or Berlin, or anywhere, and they are fighting it out. And I think part of that fight is within Donald Trump's head. So you never know how it ends.
So in a sense, Trump was hit by economic reality, and on Ukraine, he's been hit by reality as well, hasn't he? Because he's not talking about ending the war in 24 hours anymore. That kind of talk has gone. But you've also mentioned something very important, which is the contempt his administration has for Europe. And we can see that in the way Europe has been excluded from any substantive negotiations on Ukraine. Do you think there's anything the EU can do to change that, or is it really powerless?
Well, I think that the EU, or at least the Europeans, the European powers, France, the UK, and others should try to get a seat at that negotiation table at some point, because, of course, in the negotiations between the Americans and Russians in Saudi Arabia about Ukraine, what is at stake ultimately is the future of the European security architecture. It's about how the continent at large, the European continent, I would say all the way from the UK to Ukraine, holds together, how the states on the continent keep the peace. And of course, it is a bit humiliating that there are no European voices currently in that conversation.
And on defense, European defense matters, you wrote a book, as I said, Pandemonium, about how the European continent dealt with the COVID pandemic. One of the innovations we saw in that time was this joint borrowing, because people felt a real sense of urgency and threat. On defense, do you think Europeans have a similar sense of urgency?
Definitely. I think we definitely see a change in mentality. I think there's a sense of urgency across Europe. Of course, with the nuance of also where you are on the map, how close you are to Russia there in the Baltic states or Poland, there's more than a sense of urgency. It's close to panic. Whereas in Spain or Italy, it's a more relaxed attitude vis-a-vis Russia, even if in Spain, for instance, they're also very concerned about Russian cyber attacks, hybrid attacks. But overall, I think there is a political will at the level of leaders, and also public opinions, to invest more in defense and to also work more together on this. So that is a real change. And indeed, as you alluded to, some policy initiatives more here in Brussels, like this idea of joint borrowing for defense, they make their way. The Germans, who were always very opposed to these kind of measures, and when Merkel, as you mentioned, she did make an exception during the COVID crisis because of the sheer scale of human suffering in Italy and Spain at the beginning of the pandemic now 5 years ago. But she clearly said, well, this is an utterly exceptional situation and it should not set a precedent for the future. Well, 5 years on, we see we have a war. We have to deal with Putin, with an adversary in the person of Trump. And we are living, let's say, another exception. And the incoming Chancellor Friedrich Merz, who will take office in about 3-4 weeks from now, he has changed course on this. And that's, I think, looking with a bit of distance to all the actions and decisions the Europeans have taken in the past 2-3 months since Trump is in office, this is probably the most important decision taken in Europe, because Friedrich Merz, on behalf of Germany and with the new coalition, has already found the space for 500 billion of investment, not only in infrastructure and transport, which is very urgent, but also in defense. And also, in a way, so to say, exporting that loosening of the fiscal rule book to the rest of the EU.
Yeah, Merz, of course, does want to relax that debt brake, as you mentioned. But then we've seen opposition to this kind of spending in other capitals, not least in the Netherlands, where members of the Dutch parliament voted against the kind of spending required in this rearm EU plan. We've seen some opposition as well in the Italian government. So it's by no means a unanimously accepted idea.
You're right, it's not unanimously accepted. But I think, well, I don't know about the Italians in detail, but the Dutch, I think, will come along once they see how Germany's position has changed. And Germany really is the central player here, because it is the strongest economy. It had also the strictest budget rules, is very attached to them. So when Germany relaxes these rules for itself and also encourages its neighbors and European partners to do the same, that is a general movement Germany can set into motion, and that Dutch and some opposition, Italians and others, will not so easily stop. So I think the fundamental change is afoot in that field.
Just one quick final question, because we're running out of time, Luke, but I wanted to ask you about all this new talk about strategic autonomy in the EU, and you've done a lot of work on something that you call tech sovereignty. The EU Commission has presented its AI continent action plan. Do you see the EU making progress in these areas, or is it just kind of a lot of talk at the moment and not that much concrete movement?
No, I think there is an awareness that the EU in the field of AI risks being squeezed between China and US big tech, especially in the situation now that American big tech is becoming more adversarial and very closely allied to Trump. So there is this awareness that EU needs to be more independent, not only of China, but also of the US in this respect. There are startups, there are initiatives. There was a big AI summit in Paris earlier this year. Now, well, you can say, Armin, that's just all talking, but I think some of this will be followed up with dedicated investments, including with EU funding, but also in national capitals. In Poland alone last year, it was to the tune of $500 million investment in AI startups. So this is really a continental effort in Washington. They look at the 21st century as the era of AI, of wars that are fought with different means, and so do the Chinese. So all of this, I think, also for Europe, is linked to getting ready for a new rougher era, a rougher world order, where we have to be able to defend ourselves, and the awareness that AI and technology are part of that overall government and societal effort is definitely rising. And I'm very happy to see that some of this is now being followed up.
Yes, the EU certainly needs to get into the AI game more. Thank you so much for being my guest. We'll leave it there. Luc Van Middelaar, Director of the Brussels Institute for Geopolitics, joining me from Belgian capital. Thanks for watching us here on Talking Europe.